Welcome to Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta.
This episode is a live session from day 4 of Jaipur Lit Fest 2023. And it's called Guru to the World, the Life and Legacy of Vivekanand. Ruth Harris in conversation with Hindol Sengupta.
You know, talking about Vivekananda in India is not easy. He means different things to different people. He means something to everybody. And, you know, no matter what you say in India, it seems, about Vivekananda, it's never quite enough. So I actually wanted to begin by asking you a very simple question. How did you come to write about Vivekananda? And then we can go into the book.
Well, two things I'd like to say. I'd like to start by saying that it may be difficult because there are so many views of Vivekananda, but it's in India, but it's a joy to speak to an audience of people who really know about Vivekananda and feel and care about him. I usually have to start in my audiences in America and in Britain with a lot of throat clearing, where I try and I assert that why is it that in the West we've only heard of Gandhi when Vivekananda is one of the most important global thinkers of the 19th and 20th century? So that's despite the dangers as a foreigner of wading into these waters, I'd like to say thank you for coming. The next thing is I came to this through reading Romain Rolland. He was a French pacifist and internationalist, and he had this extraordinary fantasy that Gandhi was going to come to the West and he was going to lead the fascist struggle and save Europe from itself. And it's amazing, it's an amazing story. Gandhi does come, they correspond, they interact through Mirabeau, one of the Admiral Slade's daughter. And it was in this time that he gets information about Ramakrishna Vivekananda from one of Vivekananda's American acolytes, Josephine McLeod. And that was my first encounter with these two men. And it immediately awakened me to the possibility of rethinking the impact of Indian thought on Western people.
You know, you mentioned Romain Rolland, and many people would know that Romain Rolland, of course, wrote about Paramhansa also.
Absolutely, you know. Yeah.
I want to then now get into your book, right? And I want to begin by asking you that towards the end of your book, you talk about how Vivekananda, in a sense, was both admiring of the West, but also chastising of the West. And today, that process, many would describe as a decolonial process. I wonder whether you could talk to us a little bit about that.
I think this is so important because it's double-sided. Vivekananda, from the moment he arrives at the parliament, is already active in this decolonial process. Now, that's the story everybody likes to tell. It's almost legendary. But I think it's important to realize he arrives and he has to make a place for himself outside of all the stereotypes. So he does that by wearing the scarlet coat and the orange turban and by addressing people as equals from the very beginning. And he actually says, sisters and brothers. And what's so amazing is that he puts his finger on a vulnerable place in America when he says, India brings spirituality, you are the materialists, you are brutal. And actually, he has the whole Chicago Exposition to talk about the values of ultra-consumerism and the obsession with money. And at the same time, he says to people who've now lost much of their Christianity, and through science and biblical criticism, that there's a new way of thinking about spirituality and spiritual universalism. And amazingly, they are astonished. They applaud him wildly. And above all, he impresses them because he says, it's a sin to call you sinners. And for them, that was an incredible release. They were, he said, concentrate on self-realization and connection with the divine. Don't concentrate on your transgressions and your failings. And for many of these people, this was a tremendous revelation. But at the same time that he was doing this in the West, he was also saying to Indians, lose your timidity, lose your subservience, do not feel like a subject person. And if you read the lectures on practical Vedanta, this is what he constantly asserts. And it's that double-sidedness of his message that makes him both profoundly provocative, stimulating, and at the same time, difficult to understand, because it seems like it's a lack of coherence, but I would say it isn't. And those two sides are very important. The final thing I would say is that despite his tremendous charisma and his ability to communicate, he also was locked into these categories, materialist West, spiritual India. And that sometimes caused him a lot of difficulties, because he was trying to show that he wasn't just transcendental, hence why he was active. He was called the cyclonic monk. At the same time, he wanted to show people that in America, that they were distracted, busy, over-concerned with material objects. So he had a tightrope to walk, and this was very difficult for him and extremely exhausting.
I want to talk to you a little bit about, because you began by talking about Romain Rolland, some of the other big names, you know, who in a sense we have been able to access Vivekananda through. Of course, we know about Max Müller. Less is known about William James, and you, of course, write, you know, in your book in some detail about this. You know, and if I could just add a corollary to that, it's almost, you know, it's a funny aside, but, you know, a lot of people believe in India. Vivekananda was not very famous as long as he was in India. Vivekananda becomes famous in India after he returns from
Absolutely.
The West.
Yes.
Right? And of course, in your book too, you write about how Vivekananda himself wrote about the thousands of people waiting to cheer him on and so on and so forth. But that's all after he returns from the West.
Yeah.
And I wonder, as even as you start to talk to us about William James, if you could reflect upon the fact that even though Vivekananda was turning the table as a man who lived in colonial India, in a sense he still needed the West as an intermediary to present himself anew, as it were, in his own culture, in his own context.
Yeah. First, let me talk about William James. There's no reason why you should have heard of him, but of course, in America, he's considered the first American global intellectual. He's seen as the creator of modern American psychology and philosophical pragmatism. When people think of, quote, American practicality and pragmatism, they think of William James. And he wrote a famous book called The Varieties of Religious Experience in 1902, the year that Vivekananda died. And this is after several interactions with Vivekananda. And I'd have to say that what he was doing was very interesting. He was saying, I don't really want to acknowledge or talk about the credos of different religions. I don't know about whether or not there is a real divinity, but I'm going to take very seriously the subjective experiences of individuals who feel that closeness, that mystical closeness to the divine. Now, of course, Vivekananda would not have agreed with that, But experience was the bridge on which they walked together, and that is how they spoke. James was also at Harvard, where there was a burgeoning interest in Sanskrit. So he, through his colleagues, had learned a lot about Indian religion. What was so interesting was that when the book finally came out, he was supposed to write a preface to Raja Yoga. He never did, William James. And then when the book finally came out, he said, Hinduism has a lot of practical benefit. It's about the sumptuosity of security. In other words, you go into your transcendental state, you ignore the world, and you find the divine. This was precisely what Vivekananda sought to reject through his activism, through his reconsideration of karma yoga. And in some ways, it was just reiterating the typical Hegelian critique of Indians as metaphysical and not interested in the world. And so even though he was the great man at Harvard, Vivekananda never criticized him, but was sure that he didn't agree. I also think that what's interesting there is that he actually retorts in different places and says, no, it's you who live in the sumptuosity of security, you Christians, because you seek to separate out good and evil. He used a metaphor of white milk, and he said, you need bits of burnt cork to know the difference, so that you know what's pure and what is not pure. The problem with Christianity and with Christians, especially Christians, is that they do not acknowledge that. And because of that, they cannot reflect on their own failings and their own foibles. These were very powerful lessons, and they were completely new to the people who were listening to them.
I also want to talk to you a little bit about Vivekananda's relationship with Sarada Devi or Sharda Devi. A lot, of course, is known about Vivekananda and Sri Ramakrishna, his guru. But apart from maybe in Bengal and within the Bengali community, not a lot of people, number one, know about Sharda Devi. They also don't know about Vivekananda's relationship, especially after Sri Ramakrishna, in a sense, left his bodily self and died, how she becomes, and you refer to this in your book, in a sense, a guiding, anchoring presence for Vivekananda and his brother monks. So I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about that relationship.
At one point, he even says that he thinks that she will become more important than Ramakrishna. Yeah. Which is a remarkable thing to say, given his love for his guru. He refuses to go to America without her permission, which is in itself remarkable. She has, apparently, it's said that she has a dream, and she tells him, go for the sake of humanity. Remember, this is this young man full of promise, but he has no samaj links. He's no longer a Brahmo. His monastery is ramshackle, and they send him off, and they worry. It's a frightening thing to do. And in the end, in order to get invited to the parliament, he has to get help from a Harvard man that he meets in the Boston area. So it's a very, very audacious undertaking. And what's so amazing about Sharada is that she has connections with the American women. And although she's an Orthodox Brahmin widow, she eats with them and she welcomes them. And so in some ways, for him, she's the ideal Hindu woman who also depends on her own judgment. And she is a spiritual force that he thinks is unequal. And I find this very interesting because this is part of his modesty. He does not see himself on the same level as Ramakrishna and Sharada. He sees himself as a legatee. And he constantly goes on about don't touchism. We must get back to the essence of Hinduism, not these useless ceremonials. But when he returns from America, he bathes in the Ganges to make sure that he's pure because he feels he's coming really to a saint. I think these things are very important. I think that we still have to reckon with her personality because she's semi-hidden. We don't have her words. But all I can say is that when mischievous disciples started up with her, she was said to have pulled out their tongues and slapped them on the face. She was a very forceful lady, and she was also famous for cooking dishes for each disciple. It's an interesting idea because it became an important metaphor for how you feed and nourish individual spirituality.
I wonder whether you could reflect a little bit on something that I spoke about a little while ago, which is Vivekananda's need, in a sense, or the need of that moment for Vivekananda to find Western interlocutors.
Oh, yes.
To sort of not only introduce him to the West, but to reintroduce him to his own context.
It's very interesting, and I'm sorry I didn't respond to that. It's, of course, a very ambivalent process for him. On the one hand, he's at first almost overawed from everything from the ice cubes in the drinks to the central heating. And again, that business of the recognition is always upsetting to have to go roundabout. And when he comes back to India, he also is resentful for a moment because he has to shave his head again and wear a cowpin and retake up again the costume of a monk. And he's very ambivalent about all of this. He depends on the West for new ideas, but at the same time, he's determined not to let his Indianness, if you'll excuse my using that term, because there's no essence of Indianness, be overwhelmed by Western values. But if you want to understand his exhaustion and his illnesses, you would take account of the fact that he's constantly negotiating this internal dilemma of wanting to hear about the newest trends in Western thought, reading about them, absorbing them very quickly, learning all about new therapeutic models, Christian Science, et cetera, et cetera. And at the same time, wanting to deflect all the cliched criticisms that people talk about India. So for example, he has to listen to people tell him, is it true mothers throw their babies to crocodiles? And this is said to him more than once. And each time, he comes back with a witty repartee, but it's also wounding. It's not just funny, it's wounding. So he has to decide how to respond. And he knows that Ramakrishna says, speak in the language of the people that you're talking to. But there's another part of him that's enraged that people are asking questions of this kind.
You know, you spoke about Swami Vivekananda's, you know, life, of course, in America and his return home. And when you were talking about his relationship with Sharda Devi, it occurred to me that, of course, the mother figure was an important element in Vivekananda's life. I mean, here was a monk who had taken every vow possible of, you know, being a monk, and yet consistently worried through his life about his own mother's, you know, well-being. And on that subject of responsibility, I wanted to ask you, of course, that was one responsibility, his own mother and her financial well-being, but also the responsibility of his brother monks, so to speak, in building the Ramakrishna mission. The mission is in a sense, is not a construct of Sri Ramakrishna, it's a construct of Vivekananda.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
Many people in India don't understand that. But, you know, so I wonder whether you want to talk to us a little bit about the creation of the mission and his responsibility towards his brother monks.
Well, before the creation of Belarmath and the mission as we know it, he writes in the early days, when they're all wandering, about the need to protect and care for his guru brothers. And it's very interesting. He writes to a Sanskrit scholar. He says, I know you think I'm just weaving a web of Maya. We shouldn't care. And what's so interesting is that he insists, even at that point, that you must care. And the monks themselves say, Vivekananda has taught us that we must care for one another. And he does. I mean, they do. It's interesting, we have a stereotype of people wandering alone. These monks often rejoined each other and came together because it was so hard to wander across India as sannyasins. But then when he comes back from America, it is in a sense already an international institution. The land is bought by a woman named Henrietta Müller, who's an Argentinian heiress of German extraction, a theosophist, who's a very difficult person. And the building's by a Bostonian named Sarah Bull, the wife of the very, very, very famous violinist. And then what he does is he's very funny. There's Belarmat rules. You must not stand around all day chattering, you know? You must work. You must exemplify the disinterestedness of karma yoga. And at the beginning, they really resist. But little by little, it becomes a very disciplined order. It becomes known as it is today as an order of incredible activism. And what's also interesting is that many of the shyest monks end up traveling around the world, establishing Vedanta societies, and of course, the pioneering work that is done on famine and plague. So these rules are very difficult. For example, they have to collect money, they have to sell newspapers. Ramakrishna had told them not to have name and fame. And just the idea of handling money or reporting on the progress of famine relief caused some of these monks anguish in the extreme. And we have their letters where they explain how difficult it is for them. And Vivekananda keeps on encouraging them not to feel these feelings, that they are on the right track. Privately, he himself has doubts. There are many times when he talks about the organization, how hard he's working, and he says to Josephine McLeod, I wish I was back in Dakshineshwar with Ramakrishna. So it takes such effort to shift their view of what a true sannyasin should be.
I just want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, if we could move from Vivekananda to you. I wanted to ask you, I'll ask you one more question before I go to that. You know, this point about activism, In a sense, it's an innovation, isn't it? Because in Vivekananda's time, this is not how monastic orders constructed themselves. Certainly, barring maybe a little bit of work that he may have seen of the Brahmo Samaj, certainly there were no parallels of this in that context in his universe. So in a sense, building such an order based on the, you know, idea of work, whereas monasticism in India has always been about a certain distance from, you know, from the world. Talk to us a little bit about this innovation, so to speak.
The innovation is obvious, but it's also not as obvious as it seems, because although he emphasizes work with a monastic spirituality. He emphasizes the notion of disinterestedness. The work will be done better if it's done with disinterest. In other words, without any claim or hope for, quote, name and fame. And that's why often people say that he deviated from Ramakrishna, but he did not feel he did because of this emphasis on disinterestedness. And although he saw this almost in a militant way for his monks, it was, of course, the model for householders as well. This is what people hoped to be able to do. And it is those teachings often derived from the Gita, which once again he hoped to convey to Westerners. And it was very counterintuitive for them. You know, the story of Arjuna on the battlefield. How could you decide to fight if it was your beloved family? And he tried to explain that it was precisely because Indians are so embedded in family, that they love them so much, that the sacrifice was so great, and that that was why they had to do it. These were lessons that were really difficult, especially in American Britain, where the idea of utilitarianism, you know, where you do for your interests, was so strong. And he was constantly making a critique of this, of a narrow view of utilitarianism. So it was work, but not just for name and fame. It was work for higher ethical purposes.
Yeah. Of course, a lot of people, you know, even in India, don't know, and I wonder if you think this is true. It is because of this distance that you're explaining to us that in the Ramakrishna Mission, one of its most renowned sort of monks, Swami Ranganathananda, when offered the Padma Vibhushan, did not accept it.
Absolutely.
Because he said that either the entire organization gets it or I can't take it, because the individual is not emphasized in the universe of the Ramakrishna Mission. But I want to, like I said, move to you. You know, you talk so beautifully in your book about the women in Vivekananda's life, right? And you mentioned some of them, Sarah Bull, for instance, mm-hmm. and Henrietta Muller. Of course, we cannot forget the most important one of them, you know, Margaret Noble, Sister Nivedita, really Vivekananda's greatest pupil, perhaps, you know, many people would argue. And you talk to us in your book about the white women, in a sense, who helped Vivekananda create his great life and legacy and his mission. As a white woman yourself, did you reflect on positionality while writing this book, on why these women were so fascinated by Vivekananda's message?
Well, I couldn't help but constantly reflect on positionality, because of course the things that I was writing about were often not the things that Indians had written about. I mean, what I found most extraordinary was, in India, he's known as a man-maker. And of course, he did speak about man-making and the Kshatriya force. But in America, he said, I am a woman amongst women. And when he spoke about his future incarnation, he said he wanted to come back as an American woman. And the reason why I mention this is because I want to focus on the multifaceted nature of Vivekananda and not to reduce him, and seeing the two sides that are actually one, and his attempt at creating unities was so important. Why did I do this? Well, in America, it's very common for people to say, oh, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious.
SBNR. Famous SBNR, yeah.
And of course, they have no idea that that possibility comes from the door-opening world that Vivekananda brought. And that's what I was trying to convey. And I was, of course, really fascinated by the issue of, it's a very simple question, why did they listen to this man? You can't just say it's his charisma, right? There was something about the message that he conveyed about universalism and spirituality that people were impressed by. But at the same time, I was really interested in getting people in the West to think about all kinds of practices that they do, that they only they think of, oh, well, that may have come from India, but that they've co-opted and misunderstood. And that's what was one of my tasks that I set myself. And they do not recognize that there was also an anti-colonial dimension, and it's undeniable. I mean, when he introduces yoga at Greenacre, Maine, he talks about the dry people, hard people that he meets. And he literally wants to introduce them to the suppleness and mildness, what he considers the mildness of Hindu culture. Now, about Sister Nivedita, I think the reason why the book is called The Legacy as well is because much of what we think about Vivekananda comes through her. I mean, and that is very important to recognize. I also think it's important to realize that in some sense, she claims that he said she was his Annie Besant in the making. And the importance that many Indian theorists had and spiritual people to have British or European women arguing their cause to the world. It's interesting that the books on Kali and turning her from a symbol of Hindu heathenism and degeneration were written by Sister Nivedita, not by Vivekananda. And that she's the one, and she says, this is not idolatry. This is not. And I have to tell you, these women were fascinated by the possibility of having a feminine godhead, because they were so used to, especially in Protestant, one that was very patriarchal. And so this, even if we have doubts today about the idealization of motherhood that he projected, they found many of these discussions about feminine, the importance of the feminine in spirituality, mind-blowing. So I think that's another point. I also think that, as I said, what they loved was that he listened and he engaged in their lives in ways that they were unaccustomed to. He wasn't like a doer Protestant preacher. And he wasn't, he cooked for them. They never had a man cook for them ever. He ground spices. It was their first encounter with Indian food. It was that joy of life, but also the proximity of his person and his willingness to engage in their difficulties and to explain to them the notion of a sadhana. This, all of this, they found very inspiring. And I think it's important to recognize that although we often think of him as having very socially conservative views of women, he took women very seriously.
Yeah, and how could he not, coming, of course, from the Ramakrishna tradition of the worship of Kali? And I want you to, because we have some time, I want you to talk a little bit about that, you know, because there has always been a debate on whether Vivekananda did enough when he was in the West to, in a sense, promote his guru's message in the most pristine, should I say, way, you know? Because Ramakrishna Paramahansa, of course, was a, you know, in Bengal they called him a madman, you know? He was an ultimate mystic who would weep before Ma Kali, the mother goddess. And, you know, some people think that Vivekananda did not, and you know, some of his brother monks thought that,
absolutely,
right? That, you know, when you went to the West, you sort of underplayed,
that's right,
you know, these elements because they were too, quote unquote, the word we would use today is exotic, right? I wonder what you think about that, because once he comes back, you know, we find Vivekananda at, you know, Mata Kheer Bhavani and in Kashmir and so on and so forth. Also his singing, you know, how much did he sing?
Right.
In the West, right? You know, the beautiful singer, well, the first thing Ramakrishna told him to do is to sing a song. Did he sing enough in the West and so on and so forth? So I wonder whether you could engage us a little bit on these subjects.
This is really, for me, extremely important, and I'm interested in your views on this. There is no doubt, in one of the reminiscences it said that if he had spoken to the Westerners about the mystical experiences of Ramakrishna, they would have thrown his master and him into a ditch. That's what he says. And it's a fascinating aside. So is it true that Vivekananda, quote, sanitizes Hinduism for Western consumption? And of course, this is really the crux of the matter. This is the question. Was he following Ramakrishna's dictum that you have to speak to people in their own language, and hence his distaste for the Christian missionaries who never understood the people that they were trying to convert? And that's, you know, really, really a fierce feeling. Or was he actually making Hinduism anodyne, refashioning it for people who could never really appreciate it? And of course, that is one of the great debates that goes on. I think it's an important debate, but I also think in many ways he was trying to be a good guru, which was like Sharada, who makes the different dishes. He was trying to convince people according to what they were capable of understanding. And I, alas, didn't bring some of the pictures of these Yankees in their Victorian suits. And, you know, it would have been, what he was trying to give was actually a lesson against muscular Christianity. He was trying to get them to open up, be more expansive. And yes, when he went back to India, people blamed him for not saying Ramakrishna was, how important Ramakrishna was. Remember, he preaches above all Advaita Vedanta. So when the monks have worship for the slippers of Ramakrishna, he at moments he gets very angry, and at other moments he accepts these devotions. So once again, this is the change that he brings. Formlessness for him is very important to the idea of universalism, because he's afraid that too much symbolism will only make people fight. They'll fight about this god, or, you know, this deity or that deity. And yet at the same time, to take away symbols means to take away traditions and intimacy. And then he's accused of creating too much homogeneity, the very thing that he abhorred when he constantly talked about diversity and unity and unity and diversity. And that goes back to that metaphor of the white milk. You know, you need all these things. But that was also because he was on the hoof. He was constantly talking live to audiences. And then that's why you can read Vivekananda and you can say, ah, gotcha. If it's something you don't like, you can say, gotcha, he said the wrong thing. And then if it's something you do like, you say, that's wonderful. You see what he believed? So it's very hard to have an overview. And because he died so young, at 39, we don't know. There's something, in my view, wonderfully mysterious about what he would have done during Swadeshi, the first Swadeshi, what he would have done for the freedom struggle in the interwar period. We will never know.
Yeah, because I think even in India, people don't understand. Vivekananda really, in a sense, saw the first Indian War of Independence, you know, and he also saw the Bengal Renaissance, in a sense, you know, a sort of comparative refurbishing of Hinduism using, some would argue, Protestant values of enlightenment and so on and so forth.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Launchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please follow or subscribe to this show wherever you're listening to this to be notified about new episodes.